another in the large hall, and they whispered to one another. Then a maidservant ran into the hall and hurriedly said something, mentioning the princess. At last, an old, cross-looking footman came and announced to the Rostovs that the prince was not receiving, but that the princess begged them to walk up. The first person who came to meet the visitors was Mademoiselle Bourienne. She greeted the father and daughter with special politeness and showed them to the princess's room. The princess, looking excited and nervous, her face flushed in patches, ran in to meet the visitors, treading heavily and vainly trying to appear cordial and at ease. From the first glance, Princess Maria did not like Natasha. She thought her too fashionably dressed, frivolously gay and vain. She did not at all realize that before having seen her future sister-in-law, she was prejudiced against her by involuntary envy of her beauty, youth, and happiness, as well as by jealousy of her brother's love for her. Apart from this insuperable antipathy to her, Princess Maria was agitated just then because on the Rostovs being announced, the old prince had shouted that he did not wish to see them, that Princess Maria might do so if she chose, but they were not to be admitted to him. She had decided to receive them, but feared lest the prince might at any moment indulge in some freak, as he seemed much upset by the Rostovs' visit. "There, my dear princess, I've brought you my songstress," said the count, bowing and looking round uneasily as if afraid the old prince might appear. "I am so glad that you should get to know one another. Very sorry the prince is still ailing." And after a few more commonplace remarks, he rose. "If you'll allow me to leave my Natasha in your hands for a quarter of an hour, Princess, I'll drive round to see Anna Semyonovna. It's quite near in the Dog Square, and then I'll come back for her." The Count had devised this diplomatic ruse, as he afterwards told his daughter, to give the future sisters-in-law an opportunity to talk to one another freely. But another motive was to avoid the danger of encountering the old prince, of whom he was afraid. He did not mention this to his daughter, but Natasha noticed her father's nervousness and anxiety, and felt mortified by it. She blushed for him, grew still angrier at having blushed, and looked at the princess with a bold and defiant expression which said that she was not afraid of anybody. The princess told the count that she would be delighted, and only begged him to stay longer at Anna Semyonovna's, and he departed. Despite the uneasy glances thrown at her by Princess Maria, who wished to have a tête-à-tête with Natasha, Mademoiselle Bourienne remained in the room and persistently talked about Moscow amusements and theatres. Natasha felt offended by the hesitation she had noticed in the anteroom, by her father's nervousness, and by the unnatural manner of the princess, who, she thought, was making a favour of receiving her, and so everything displeased her. She did not like Princess Maria, whom she thought very plain, affected, and dry. Natasha suddenly shrank into herself, and involuntarily assumed an offhand air which alienated Princess Maria still more. After 5 minutes of irksome, constrained conversation, they heard the sound of slippered feet rapidly approaching. Princess Maria looked frightened. The door opened, and the old prince in a dressing gown and a white nightcap came in.
"Ah, madam," he began. "Madam Countess, Countess Rostova, if I'm not mistaken. I beg you to excuse me, to excuse me. I did not know, madam. God is my witness. I did not know you had honoured us with a visit, and I came in such a costume only to see my daughter. I beg you to excuse me. God is my witness. I didn't know," he repeated,
stressing the word God so unnaturally and so unpleasantly that Princess Maria stood with downcast eyes, not daring to look either at her father or at Natasha. Nor did the latter, having risen and curtsied, know what to do. Mademoiselle Bourienne alone smiled agreeably.
"I beg you to excuse me, excuse me. God is my witness. I did not know," muttered the old man, and after looking Natasha over from head to foot, he went out.
Mademoiselle Bourienne was the first to recover herself after this apparition, and began speaking about the prince's indisposition. Natasha and Princess Maria looked at one another in silence, and the longer they did so without saying what they wanted to say, the greater grew their antipathy to one another. When the Count returned, Natasha was impolitely pleased and hastened to get away. At that moment, she hated the stiff, elderly princess, who could place her in such an embarrassing position and had spent half an hour with her without once mentioning Prince Andrei. "I couldn't begin talking about him in the presence of that Frenchwoman," thought Natasha. The same thought was meanwhile tormenting Princess Maria. She knew what she ought to have said to Natasha, but she had been unable to say it because Mademoiselle Bourienne was in the way, and because, without knowing why, she felt it very difficult to speak of the marriage. When the Count was already leaving the room, Princess Maria went up hurriedly to Natasha, took her by the hand, and said with a deep sigh, "Wait, I must..." Natasha glanced at her ironically without knowing why. "Dear Natalie," said Princess Maria, "I want you to know that I am glad my brother has found happiness." She paused, feeling that she was not telling the truth. Natasha noticed this and guessed its reason.
"I think, Princess, it is not convenient to speak of that now," she said with external dignity and coldness, though she felt the tears choking her. "What have I said and what have I done?" thought she, as soon as she was out of the room. They waited a long time for Natasha to come to dinner that day. She sat in her room, crying like a child, blowing her nose and sobbing. Sonia stood beside her, kissing her hair. "Natasha, what is it all about?" she asked. "What do they matter to you? It will all pass, Natasha."
"But if you only knew how offensive it was, as if I..."
"Don't talk about it, Natasha. It wasn't your fault, so why should you mind? Kiss me," said Sonia.
Natasha raised her head, and kissing her friend on the lips, pressed her wet face against her.
"I can't tell you. I don't know. No one's to blame," said Natasha. "It's my fault. But it all hurts terribly. Oh, why doesn't he come?"
She came into dinner with red eyes. Maria Dmitrievna, who knew how the prince had received the Rostovs, pretended not to notice how upset Natasha was, and jested resolutely and loudly at table with the Count and the other guests. Chapter 8. The Rostovs at the Opera. That evening the Rostovs went to the opera, for which Maria Dmitrievna had taken a box. Natasha did not want to go, but could not refuse Maria Dmitrievna's kind offer, which was intended expressly for her. When she came ready-dressed into the ballroom to await her father, and looking in the large mirror there, saw that she was pretty, very pretty, she felt even more sad. But it was a sweet, tender sadness.
"Oh, God, if he were here now, I would not behave as I did then, but differently. I would not be silly and afraid of things. I would simply embrace him, cling to him, and make him look at me with those searching, inquiring eyes with which he has so often looked at me. And then I would make him laugh, as he used to laugh. And his eyes! How I see those eyes!" thought Natasha. "And what do his father and sister matter to me? I love him alone, him, with that face and those eyes, with his smile, manly and yet childlike. No, I had better not think of him, but forget him, quite forget him for the present. I can't bear this waiting, and I shall cry in a minute."
And she turned away from the glass, making an effort not to cry.
"And how can Sonia love Nikolai so calmly and quietly, and wait so long and so patiently?" thought she, looking at Sonia, who also came in quite ready with a fan in her hand. "No, she's altogether different. I can't."
Natasha at that moment felt so softened and tender that it was not enough for her to love and to know she was beloved. She wanted now at once to embrace the man she loved, to speak and hear from him words of love such as filled her heart. While she sat in the carriage beside her father, pensively watching the lights of the street lamps flickering on the frozen window, she felt still sadder and more in love, and forgot where she was going and with whom. Having fallen into the line of carriages, the Rostovs' carriage drove up to the theatre, its wheels squeaking over the snow. Natasha and Sonia, holding up their dresses, jumped out quickly. The Count got helped out by the footman, and passing among men and women who were entering and the programme sellers, they all three went along the corridor to the first row of boxes. Through the closed doors, the music was already audible.
"Natasha, your hair!" whispered Sonia.
An attendant deferentially and quickly slipped before the ladies and opened the door of their box. The music sounded louder, and through the door rows of brightly lit boxes, in which ladies sat with bare arms and shoulders, and noisy stalls brilliant with uniforms glittered before their eyes. A lady entering the next box shot a glance of feminine envy at Natasha. The curtain had not yet risen, and the overture was being played. Natasha, smoothing her gown, went in with Sonia and sat down, scanning the brilliant tiers of boxes opposite. A sensation she had not experienced for a long time, that of hundreds of eyes looking at her bare arms and neck, suddenly affected her both agreeably and disagreeably, and called up a whole crowd of memories, desires, and emotions associated with that feeling. The two remarkably pretty girls, Natasha and Sonia, with Count Rostov, who had not been seen in Moscow for a long time, attracted general attention. Moreover, everybody knew vaguely of Natasha's engagement to Prince Andrei, and knew that the Rostovs had lived in the country ever since, and all looked with curiosity at a fiancé who was making one of the best matches in Russia. Natasha's looks, as everyone told her, had improved in the country, and that evening, thanks to her agitation, she was particularly pretty. She struck those who saw her by her fullness of life and beauty, combined with her indifference to everything about her. Her black eyes looked at the crowd without seeking anyone, and her delicate arm, bare to above the elbow, lay on the velvet edge of the box, while, evidently unconsciously, she opened and closed her hand in time to the music, crumpling her programme.
"Look, there's Alenina," said Sonia. "With her mother, isn't it?"
"Dear me! Mikhail Kirillovich has grown still stouter," remarked the Count.
"Look at our Anna Mikhailovna. What a headdress she has on."
"The Karagins. Julie and Boris with them. One can see at once that they're engaged."
"Drubetskoy's proposed?"
"Oh, yes, I heard it today," said Shinshin, coming into the Rostov's box.
Natasha looked in the direction in which her father's eyes were turned and saw Julie sitting beside her mother with a happy look on her face and a string of pearls round her thick red neck, which Natasha knew was covered with powder. Behind them, wearing a smile and leaning over with an ear to Julie's mouth, was Boris's handsome, smoothly brushed head. He looked at the Rostovs from under his brows and said something, smiling, to his betrothed.
"They are talking about us, about me and him," thought Natasha. "And he, no doubt, is calming her jealousy of me. They needn't trouble themselves. If only they knew how little I am concerned about any of them."
Behind them sat Anna Mikhailovna, wearing a green headdress and with a happy look of resignation to the will of God on her face. Their box was pervaded by that atmosphere of an affianced couple which Natasha knew so well and liked so much. She turned away and suddenly remembered all that had been so humiliating in her morning's visit.
"What right has he not to wish to receive me into his family? Oh, better not think of it. Not till he comes back," she told herself, and began looking at the faces, some strange and some familiar, in the stalls.
In the front, in the very centre, leaning back against the orchestra rail, stood Dolokhov, in a Persian dress, his curly hair brushed up into a huge shock. He stood in full view of the audience, well aware that he was attracting everyone's attention, yet as much at ease as though he were in his own room. Around him thronged Moscow's most brilliant young men, whom he evidently dominated. The Count, laughing, nudged the blushing Sonia and pointed to her former adorer.
"Do you recognize him?" said he. "And where has he sprung from?" he asked, turning to Shinshin. "Didn't he vanish somewhere?"
"He did," replied Shinshin. "He was in the Caucasus and ran away from there.
They say he has been acting as minister to some ruling prince in Persia, where he killed the Shah's brother. Now all the Moscow ladies are mad about him. It's Dolokhov the Persian that does it. We never hear a word but Dolokhov is mentioned. They swear by him. They offer him to you as they would a dish of choice sterlet. Dolokhov and Anatol Kuragin have turned all our ladies' heads. A tall, beautiful woman with a mass of plaited hair and much exposed plump white shoulders and neck, round which she wore a double string of large pearls, entered the adjoining box, rustling her heavy silk dress, and took a long time settling into her place. Natasha involuntarily gazed at that neck, those shoulders and pearls and coiffure, and admired the beauty of the shoulders and the pearls. While Natasha was fixing her gaze on her for the second time, the lady looked round and, meeting the Count's eyes, nodded to him and smiled. She was the Countess Bezukhova, Pierre's wife, and the Count, who knew everyone in society, leaned over and spoke to her.
"Have you been here long, Countess?" he inquired. "I'll call. I'll call to kiss your hand. I'm here on business, and have brought my girls with me. They say Semyonova acts marvellously. Count Pierre never used to forget us. Is he here?"
"Yes, he meant to look in," answered Hélène, and glanced attentively at Natasha. Count Rostov resumed his seat.
"Handsome, isn't she?"
he whispered to Natasha. "Wonderful," answered Natasha. "She's a woman one could easily fall in love with." Just then the last chords of the overture were heard, and the conductor tapped with his stick. Some latecomers took their seats in the stalls, and the curtain rose. As soon as it rose, everyone in the boxes and stalls became silent, and all the men, old and young, in uniform and evening dress, and all the women with gems on their bare flesh, turned their whole attention with eager curiosity to the stage. Natasha, too, began to look at it. Chapter 9. The floor of the stage consisted of smooth boards. At the sides was some painted cardboard representing trees, and at the back was a cloth stretched over boards. In the centre of the stage sat some girls in red bodices and white skirts. One very fat girl in a white silk dress sat apart on a low bench, to the back of which a piece of green cardboard was glued. They all sang something. When they had finished their song, the girl in white went up to the prompter's box, and a man with tight silk trousers over his stout legs and holding a plume and a dagger went up to her and began singing, waving his arms about. First the man in the tight trousers sang alone, then she sang, then they both paused while the orchestra played and the man fingered the hand of the girl in white, obviously awaiting the beat to start singing with her. They sang together, and everyone in the theatre began clapping and shouting, while the man and woman on the stage, who represented lovers, began smiling, spreading out their arms and bowing. After her life in the country and in her present serious mood, all this seemed grotesque and amazing to Natasha. She could not follow the opera nor even listen to the music. She saw only the painted cardboard and the queerly dressed men and women who moved, spoke, and sung so strangely in that brilliant light. She knew what it was all meant to represent, but it was so pretentiously false and unnatural that she first felt ashamed for the actors and then amused at them. She looked at the faces of the audience, seeking in them the same sense of ridicule and perplexity she herself experienced, but they all seemed attentive to what was happening on the stage, and expressed delight which to Natasha seemed feigned. "I suppose it has to be like this," she thought. She kept looking round in turn at the rows of pomaded heads in the stalls, and then at the semi-nude women in the boxes, especially at Hélène in the next box, who, apparently quite unclothed, sat with a quiet, tranquil smile, not taking her eyes off the stage. And feeling the bright light that flooded the whole place and the warm air heated by the crowd, Natasha little by little began to pass into a state of intoxication she had not experienced for a long while. She did not realize who and where she was, nor what was going on before her. As she looked and thought, the strangest fancies unexpectedly and disconnectedly passed through her mind. The idea occurred to her of jumping onto the edge of the box and singing the air the actress was singing. Then she wished to touch with her fan an old gentleman sitting not far from her, then to lean over to Hélène and tickle her. At a moment when all was quiet before the commencement of a song, a door leading to the stalls on the side nearest the Rostovs' box creaked, and the steps of a belated arrival were heard.
"There's Kuragin," whispered Shinshin.
Countess Bezukhova turned smiling to the newcomer, and Natasha, following the direction of that look, saw an exceptionally handsome adjutant approaching their box with a self-assured yet courteous bearing. This was Anatole Kuragin, whom she had seen and noticed long ago at the ball in Petersburg. He was now in an adjutant's uniform with one epaulette and a shoulder knot. He moved with a restrained swagger, which would have been ridiculous had he not been so good-looking, and had his handsome face not worn such an expression of good-humoured complacency and gaiety. Though the performance was proceeding, he walked deliberately down the carpeted gangway, his sword and spurs slightly jingling, and his handsome, perfumed head held high. Having looked at Natasha, he approached his sister, laid his well-gloved hand on the edge of her box, nodded to her, and leaning forward asked a question with a motion toward Natasha.
"Mais charmante," said he,
evidently referring to Natasha, who did not exactly hear his words, but understood them from the movement of his lips. Then he took his place in the front row of the stalls and sat down beside Dolokhov, nudging with his elbow in a friendly and offhand way that Dolokhov whom others treated so fawningly. He winked at him gaily, smiled, and rested his foot against the orchestra screen.
"How like the brother is to the sister," remarked the Count, "and how handsome they both are."
Shinshin, lowering his voice, began to tell the Count of some intrigue of Kuragin's in Moscow, and Natasha tried to overhear it just because he had said she was charmante. The first act was over. In the stalls everyone began moving about, going out and coming in. Boris came to the Rostovs' box, received their congratulations very simply, and raising his eyebrows with an absent-minded smile, conveyed to Natasha and Sonya his fiancée's invitation to her wedding, and went away. Natasha, with a gay, coquettish smile, talked to him and congratulated on his approaching wedding that same Boris with whom she had formerly been in love. In the state of intoxication she was in, everything seemed simple and natural. The scantily clad Hélène smiled at everyone in the same way, and Natasha gave Boris a similar smile. Hélène's box was filled and surrounded from the stalls by the most distinguished and intellectual men, who seemed to vie with one another in their wish to let everyone see that they knew her. During the whole of that entr'acte, Kuragin stood with Dolokhov in front of the orchestra partition, looking at the Rostovs' box. Natasha knew he was talking about her, and this afforded her pleasure. She even turned so that he should see her profile in what she thought was its most becoming aspect. Before the beginning of the second act, Pierre appeared in the stalls. The Rostovs had not seen him since their arrival. His face looked sad, and he had grown still stouter since Natasha last saw him. He passed up to the front rows, not noticing anyone. Anatole went up to him and began speaking to him, looking at and indicating the Rostovs' box. On seeing Natasha, Pierre grew animated and, hastily passing between the rows, came toward their box. When he got there, he leaned on his elbows and, smiling, talked to her for a long time. While conversing with Pierre, Natasha heard a man's voice in Countess Bezukhova's box, and something told her it was Kuragin. She turned, and their eyes met. Almost smiling, he gazed straight into her eyes with such an enraptured, caressing look that it seemed strange to be so near him, to look at him like that, to be so sure he admired her, and not to be acquainted with him. In the second act, there was scenery representing tombstones. There was a round hole in the canvas to represent the moon. Shades were raised over the footlights. And from horns and contrabass came deep notes, while many people appeared from right and left wearing black cloaks and holding things like daggers in their hands. They began waving their arms. Then some other people ran in and began dragging away the maiden, who had been in white and was now in light blue. They did not drag her away at once, but sang with her for a long time, and then at last dragged her off. And behind the scenes, something metallic was struck 3 times, and everyone knelt down and sang a prayer. All these things were repeatedly interrupted by the enthusiastic shouts of the audience. During this act, every time Natasha looked toward the stalls, she saw Anatol Kuragin with an arm thrown across the back of his chair, staring at her. She was pleased to see that he was captivated by her, and it did not occur to her that there was anything wrong in it. When the second act was over, Countess Bezukhova rose, turned to the Rostovs' box, her whole bosom completely exposed, beckoned the old count with a gloved finger, and paying no attention to those who had entered her box, began talking to him with an amiable smile. "Do make me acquainted with your charming daughters," said she. "The whole town is singing their praises, and I don't even know them." Natasha rose and curtsied to the splendid countess. She was so pleased by praise from this brilliant beauty that she blushed with pleasure. "I want to become a Muscovite too now," said Hélène. "How is it you're not ashamed to bury such pearls in the country?" Countess Bezukhova quite deserved her reputation of being a fascinating woman. She could say what she did not think, especially what was flattering, quite simply and naturally. "Dear Count, you must let me look after your daughters. Though I am not staying here long this time, nor are you, I will try to amuse them. I have already heard much of you in Petersburg and wanted to get to know you," said she to Natasha, with her stereotyped and lovely smile. "I had heard about you from my page, Drubetskoy. Have you heard he is getting married? And also from my husband's friend Bolkonsky, Prince Andrei Bolkonsky," she went on with special emphasis, implying that she knew of his relation to Natasha. To get better acquainted, she asked that one of the young ladies should come into her box for the rest of the performance, and Natasha moved over to it. The scene of the third act represented a palace in which many candles were burning and pictures of knights with short beards hung on the walls. In the middle stood what were probably a king and a queen. The king waved his right arm and, evidently nervous, sang something badly and sat down on a crimson throne. The maid, who had been first in white and then in light blue, now wore only a smock and stood beside the throne with her hair down. She sang something mournfully, addressing the queen, but the king waved his arm severely, and men and women with bare legs came in from both sides and began dancing all together. Then the violins played very shrilly and merrily, and one of the women with thick bare legs and thin arms, separating from the others, went behind the wings, adjusted her bodice, returned to the middle of the stage, and began jumping and striking one foot rapidly against the other. In the stalls everyone clapped and shouted, "Bravo!" Then one of the men went into a corner of the stage. The cymbals and horns in the orchestra struck up more loudly, and this man with bare legs jumped very high and waved his feet about very rapidly. He was Duport, who received 60,000 rubles a year for this art. Everybody in the stalls, boxes and galleries began clapping and shouting with all their might, and the man stopped and began smiling and bowing to all sides. Then other men and women danced with bare legs. Then the king again shouted to the sound of the music, and they all began singing. But suddenly a storm came on. Chromatic scales and diminished sevenths were heard in the orchestra. Everyone ran off, again dragging one of their number away, and the curtain dropped. Once more there was a terrible noise and clatter among the audience, and with rapturous faces everyone began shouting, "Duport! Duport! Duport!" Natasha no longer thought this strange. She looked about with pleasure, smiling joyfully. "Isn't Duport delightful?" Hélène asked her. "Oh, yes," replied Natasha. Chapter 10. Hélène presents Anatole to Natasha. During the entr'acte, a whiff of cold air came into Hélène's box. The door opened, and Anatole entered, stooping and trying not to brush against anyone.
"Let me introduce my brother to you," said Hélène, her eyes shifting uneasily from Natasha to Anatole.
Natasha turned her pretty little head toward the elegant young officer and smiled at him over her bare shoulder. Anatole, who was as handsome at close quarters as at a distance, sat down beside her and told her he had long wished to have this happiness, ever since the Naryshkins' ball, in fact, at which he had had the well-remembered pleasure of seeing her. Kurágin was much more sensible and simple with women than among men. He talked boldly and naturally, and Natasha was strangely and agreeably struck by the fact that there was nothing formidable in this man about whom there was so much talk, but that, on the contrary, his smile was most naive, cheerful, and good-natured. Kurágin asked her opinion of the performance and told her how at a previous performance Semyonova had fallen down on the stage.
"And do you know, Countess,"
he said, suddenly addressing her as an old familiar acquaintance, "we are getting up a costume tournament. You ought to take part in it. It'll be great fun. We shall all meet at the Karagins'. Please come. No, really, eh?" said he. While saying this, he never removed his smiling eyes from her face, her neck, and her bare arms. Natasha knew for certain that he was enraptured by her. This pleased her, yet his presence made her feel constrained and oppressed. When she was not looking at him, she felt that he was looking at her shoulders, and she involuntarily caught his eye so that he should look into hers rather than this. But looking into his eyes, she was frightened, realizing that there was not that barrier of modesty she had always felt between herself and other men. She did not know how it was that within 5 minutes she had come to feel herself terribly near to this man. When she turned away, she feared he might seize her from behind by her bare arm and kiss her on the neck. They spoke of most ordinary things, yet she felt that they were closer to one another than she had ever been to any man. Natasha kept turning to Hélène and to her father, as if asking what it all meant, but Hélène was engaged in conversation with a general and did not answer her look, and her father's eyes said nothing but what they always said, "Having a good time? Well, I'm glad of it." During one of those moments of awkward silence, when Anatole's prominent eyes were gazing calmly and fixedly at her, Natasha, to break the silence, asked him how he liked Moscow. She asked the question and blushed. She felt all the time that by talking to him she was doing something improper. Anatole smiled, as though to encourage her. "At first I did not like it much, because what makes a town pleasant, ce sont les jolies femmes, the pretty women, isn't that so? But now I like it very much indeed," he said, looking at her significantly. "You'll come to the costume tournament, Countess? Do come." And putting out his hand to her bouquet and dropping his voice, he added, "You will be the prettiest there. Do come, dear Countess, and give me this flower as a pledge." Natasha did not understand what he was saying any more than he did himself, but she felt that his incomprehensible words had an improper intention. She did not know what to say and turned away as if she had not heard his remark. But as soon as she had turned away, she felt that he was there, behind, so close behind her. "How is he now? Confused? Angry? Ought I to put it right?" she asked herself, and she could not refrain from turning round. She looked straight into his eyes, and his nearness, self-assurance, and the good-natured tenderness of his smile vanquished her. She smiled just as he was doing, gazing straight into his eyes. And again she felt with horror that no barrier lay between him and her. The curtain rose again. Anatole left the box, serene and gay. Natasha went back to her father in the other box, now quite submissive to the world she found herself in. All that was going on before her now seemed quite natural, but on the other hand, all her previous thoughts of her betrothed, of Princess Maria, or of life in the country, did not once recur to her mind and were as if belonging to a remote past. In the fourth act there was some sort of devil who sang, waving his arm about, till the boards were withdrawn from under him and he disappeared down below. That was the only part of the fourth act that Natasha saw. She felt agitated and tormented, and the cause of this was Kuragin, whom she could not help watching. As they were leaving the theatre, Anatole came up to them, called their carriage and helped them in. As he was putting Natasha in, he pressed her arm above the elbow. Agitated and flushed, she turned round. He was looking at her with glittering eyes, smiling tenderly. Only after she had reached home was Natasha able clearly to think over what had happened to her, and suddenly remembering Prince Andrei, she was horrified. And at tea to which all had sat down after the opera, she gave a loud exclamation, flushed, and ran out of the room.
"Oh, God, I am lost," she said to herself. "How could I let him?"
She sat for a long time, hiding her flushed face in her hands, trying to realize what had happened to her, but was unable either to understand what had happened or what she felt. Everything seemed dark, obscure, and terrible. There, in that enormous illuminated theatre where the bare-legged Duport, in a tinsel-decorated jacket, jumped about to the music on wet boards, and young girls and old men and the nearly naked Hélène, with her proud, calm smile, rapturously cried, "Bravo!" There, in the presence of that Hélène, it had all seemed clear and simple. But now, alone by herself, it was incomprehensible. What is it? What was the terror I felt of him? What is this gnawing of conscience I am feeling now? She thought. Only to the old countess at night in bed could Natasha have told all she was feeling. She knew that Sonia, with her severe and simple views, would either not understand it at all or would be horrified at such a confession. So Natasha tried to solve what was torturing her by herself.
"Am I spoiled for Andrei's love or not?" she asked herself, and with soothing irony replied, "What a fool I am to ask that! What did happen to me? Nothing. I have done nothing. I didn't lead him on at all. Nobody will know, and I shall never see him again," she told herself. "So it is plain that nothing has happened, and there is nothing to repent of, and Andrei can love me still. But why still? Oh, God, why isn't he here?"
Natasha quieted herself for a moment, but again some instinct told her that though all this was true, and though nothing had happened, yet the former purity of her love for Prince Andrei had perished. And again in imagination she went over her whole conversation with Kuragin, and again saw the face, gestures, and tender smile of that bold, handsome man, when he pressed her arm. Chapter 11. Anatole and Dolokhov in Moscow. Anatole Kuragin was staying in Moscow because his father had sent him away from Petersburg, where he had been spending 20,000 rubles a year in cash, besides running up debts for as much more, which his creditors demanded from his father. His father announced to him that he would now pay half his debts for the last time, but only on condition that he went to Moscow as adjutant to the commander-in-chief, a post his father had procured for him, and would at last try to make a good match there. He indicated to him Princess Maria and Julie Karagina. Anatole consented and went to Moscow, where he put up at Pierre's house. Pierre received him unwillingly at first, but got used to him after a while, sometimes even accompanied him on his carousals and gave him money under the guise of loans. As Shinshin had remarked, from the time of his arrival Anatole had turned the heads of the Moscow ladies, especially by the fact that he slighted them and plainly preferred the gypsy girls and French actresses, with the chief of whom, Mademoiselle Georges, he was said to be on intimate relations. He had never missed a carousal at Danilov's or other Moscow revellers, drank whole nights through, outvying everyone else, and was at all the balls and parties of the best society. There was talk of his intrigues with some of the ladies, and he flirted with a few of them at the balls, But he did not run after the unmarried girls, especially the rich heiresses, who were most of them plain. There was a special reason for this, as he had got married 2 years before, a fact known only to his most intimate friends. At that time, while with his regiment in Poland, a Polish landowner of small means had forced him to marry his daughter. Anatole had very soon abandoned his wife, and, for a payment which he agreed to send to his father-in-law, had arranged to be free to pass himself off as a bachelor. Anatole was always content with his position, with himself and with others. He was instinctively and thoroughly convinced that it was impossible for him to live otherwise than as he did, and that he had never in his life done anything base. He was incapable of considering how his actions might affect others, or what the consequences of this or that action of his might be. He was convinced that, as a duck is so made that it must live in water, so God had made him such that he must spend 30,000 roubles a year and always occupy a prominent position in society. He believed this so firmly that others, looking at him, were persuaded of it too, and did not refuse him either a leading place in society or money, which he borrowed from anyone and everyone, and evidently would not repay. He was not a gambler. At any rate, he did not care about winning. He was not vain. He did not mind what people thought of him. Still less could he be accused of ambition. More than once he had vexed his father by spoiling his own career, and he laughed at distinctions of all kinds. He was not mean, and did not refuse anyone who asked of him. All he cared about was gaiety and women, and as according to his ideas there was nothing dishonourable in these tastes, and he was incapable of considering what the gratification of his tastes entailed for others, he honestly considered himself irreproachable, sincerely despised rogues and bad people, and with a tranquil conscience carried his head high. Rakes, those male Magdalens, have a secret feeling of innocence similar to that which female Magdalens have, based on the same hope of forgiveness. All will be forgiven her, for she loved much, and all will be forgiven him, for he enjoyed much. Dolokhov, who had reappeared that year in Moscow after his exile and his Persian adventures, and was leading a life of luxury, gambling, and dissipation, associated with his old Petersburg comrade Kuragin and made use of him for his own ends. Anatole was sincerely fond of Dolokhov for his cleverness and audacity. Dolokhov, who needed Anatole Kuragin's name, position, and connections as a bait to draw rich young men into his gambling set, made use of him and amused himself at his expense without letting the other feel it. Apart from the advantage he derived from Anatole, the very process of dominating another's will was in itself a pleasure, a habit, and a necessity to Dolokhov. Natasha had made a strong impression on Kuragin. At supper after the opera, he described to Dolokhov, with the air of a connoisseur, the attractions of her arms, shoulders, feet, and hair, and expressed his intention of making love to her. Anatole had no notion and was incapable of considering what might come of such love-making, as he never had any notion of the outcome of any of his actions. "She's first-rate, my dear fellow." "But not for us," replied Dolokhov. "I will tell my sister to ask her to dinner," said Anatole. "Eh?" "You'd better wait till she's married. You know, I adore little girls. They lose their heads at once," pursued Anatole. "You have been caught once already by a little girl," said Dolokhov, who knew of Kuragin's marriage. "Take care." "Well, that can't happen twice, eh?" said Anatole, with a good-humoured laugh. Chapter 12. Hélène visits the Rostovs. The day after the opera, the Rostovs went nowhere and nobody came to see them. Marya Dmitrievna talked to the Count about something which they concealed from Natasha. Natasha guessed they were talking about the old prince and planning something, and this disquieted and offended her. She was expecting Prince Andrei any moment, and twice that day sent a manservant to the Vozdvizhenka to ascertain whether he had come. He had not arrived. She suffered more now than during her first days in Moscow. To her impatience and pining for him were now added the unpleasant recollection of her interview with Princess Maria and the old prince, and a fear and anxiety of which she did not understand the cause. She continually fancied that either he would never come, or that something would happen to her before he came. She could no longer think of him by herself calmly and continuously as she had done before. As soon as she began to think of him, the recollection of the old prince, of Princess Maria, of the theatre, and of Kuragin mingled with her thoughts. The question again presented itself whether she was not guilty, whether she had not already broken faith with Prince Andrei, and again she found herself recalling to the minutest detail every word, every gesture, and every shade in the play of expression on the face of the man who had been able to arouse in her such an incomprehensible and terrifying feeling. To the family, Natasha seemed livelier than usual, but she was far less tranquil and happy than before. On Sunday morning, Maria Dmitrievna invited her visitors to Mass at her parish church, the Church of the Assumption, built over the graves of victims of the plague. "I don't like those fashionable churches," she said, evidently priding herself on her independence of thought. "God is the same everywhere. We have an excellent priest. He conducts the service decently and with dignity, and the deacon is the same. What holiness is there in giving concerts in the choir? I don't like it. It's just self-indulgence." Maria Dmitrievna liked Sundays and knew how to keep them. Her whole house was scrubbed and cleaned on Saturdays. Neither she nor the servants worked, and they all wore holiday dress and went to church. At her table there were extra dishes at dinner, and the servants had vodka and roast goose or suckling pig. But in nothing in the house was the holiday so noticeable as in Maria Dmitrievna's broad, stern face, which on that day wore an invariable look of solemn festivity. After Mass, when they had finished their coffee in the dining-room, where the loose covers had been removed from the furniture, a servant announced that the carriage was ready, and Maria Dmitrievna rose with a stern air. She wore her holiday shawl, in which she paid calls, and announced that she was going to see Prince Nikolai Bolkonski to have an explanation with him about Natasha. After she had gone, a dressmaker from Madame Super Roguet waited on the Rostovs, and Natasha, very glad of this diversion, having shut herself into a room adjoining the drawing-room, occupied herself trying on the new dresses. Just as she had put on a bodice without sleeves and only tacked together, and was turning her head to see in the glass how the back fitted, she heard in the drawing-room the animated sounds of her father's voice and another's, a woman's, that made her flush. It was Hélène. Natasha had not time to take off the bodice before the door opened, and Countess Bezukhova, dressed in a purple velvet gown with a high collar, came into the room beaming with good-humoured, amiable smiles. "Oh, my enchantress," she cried to the blushing Natasha. "Charming! No, this is really beyond anything, my dear Count," said she to Count Rostov, who had followed her in. "How can you live in Moscow and go nowhere? No, I won't let you off. Mademoiselle Georges will recite at my house tonight, and there'll be some people. And if you don't bring your lovely girls, who are prettier than Mademoiselle Georges, I won't know you. My husband is away in Tver, or I would send him to fetch you. You must come, you positively must, between 8 and 9. She nodded to the dressmaker, whom she knew, and who had curtsied respectfully to her, and seated herself in an armchair beside the looking-glass, draping the folds of her velvet dress picturesquely. She did not cease chattering good-naturedly and gaily, continually praising Natasha's beauty. She looked at Natasha's dresses and praised them, as well as a new dress of her own made of metallic gauze, which she had received from Paris, and advised Natasha to have one like it. "But anything suits you, my charmer," she remarked. A smile of pleasure never left Natasha's face. She felt happy, and as if she were blossoming under the praise of this dear Countess Bezukhova, who had formerly seemed to her so unapproachable and important, and was now so kind to her. Natasha brightened up, and felt almost in love with this woman, who was so beautiful and so kind. Hélène, for her part, was sincerely delighted with Natasha, and wished to give her a good time. Anatole had asked her to bring him and Natasha together, and she was calling on the Rostovs for that purpose. The idea of throwing her brother and Natasha together amused her. Though at one time in Petersburg she had been annoyed with Natasha for drawing Boris away, she did not think of that now, and in her own way heartily wished Natasha well. As she was leaving the Rostovs, she called her protégé aside.
"My brother dined with me yesterday. We nearly died of laughter. He ate nothing and kept sighing for you, my charmer. He is madly, quite madly in love with you, my dear."
Natasha blushed scarlet when she heard this.
"How she blushes, how she blushes, my pretty," said Hélène. "You must certainly come. If you love somebody, my charmer, that is not a reason to shut yourself up. Even if you are engaged, I'm sure your fiancé would wish you to go into society rather than be bored to death." "So, she knows I am engaged, and she and her husband Pierre, that good Pierre, have talked and laughed about this. So it's all right."
And again, under Hélène's influence, what had seemed terrible now seemed simple and natural.
"And she is such a grande dame, so kind, and evidently likes me so much. And why not enjoy myself?" thought Natasha, gazing at Hélène with wide-open, wondering eyes.
Marya Dmitrievna came back to dinner, taciturn and serious, having evidently suffered a defeat at the old prince's. She was still too agitated by the encounter to be able to talk of the affair calmly. In answer to the Count's inquiries, she replied that things were all right and that she would tell about it next day. On hearing of Countess Bezukhova's visit and the invitation for that evening, Marya Dmitrievna remarked, "I don't care to have anything to do with Bezukhova and don't advise you to. However, if you've promised, go. It will divert your thoughts," she added, addressing Natasha.
Chapter 13. The Reception at Hélène's. Mademoiselle Georges' Recitation.
Count Rostov took the girls to Countess Bezukhova's. There were a good many people there, but nearly all strangers to Natasha. Count Rostov was displeased to see that the company consisted almost entirely of men and women known for the freedom of their conduct. Mademoiselle Georges was standing in a corner of the drawing-room, surrounded by young men. There were several Frenchmen present, among them Métivier, who from the time Hélène had reached Moscow had been an intimate in her house. The Count decided not to sit down to cards or let his girls out of his sight, and to get away as soon as Mademoiselle Georges's performance was over. Anatole was at the door, evidently on the lookout for the Rostovs. Immediately after greeting the Count, he went up to Natasha and followed her. As soon as she saw him, she was seized by the same feeling she had had at the opera, gratified vanity at his admiration of her, and fear at the absence of a moral barrier between them. Hélène welcomed Natasha delightedly, and was loud in admiration of her beauty and her dress. Soon after their arrival, Mademoiselle Georges went out of the room to change her costume. In the drawing-room, people began arranging the chairs and taking their seats. Anatole moved a chair for Natasha and was about to sit down beside her, but the Count, who never lost sight of her, took the seat himself. Anatole sat down behind her. Mademoiselle Georges, with her bare, fat, dimpled arms and a red shawl draped over one shoulder, came into the space left vacant for her and assumed an unnatural pose. Enthusiastic whispering was audible. Mademoiselle Georges looked sternly and gloomily at the audience and began reciting some French verses describing her guilty love for her son. In some places she raised her voice, in others she whispered, lifting her head triumphantly. Sometimes she paused and uttered hoarse sounds, rolling her eyes.
"Adorable! Divine!
Delicious, was heard from every side. Natasha looked at the fat actress, but neither saw nor heard nor understood anything of what went on before her. She only felt herself again completely borne away into this strange, senseless world, so remote from her old world, a world in which it was impossible to know what was good or bad, reasonable or senseless. Behind her sat Anatole, and conscious of his proximity, she experienced a frightening sense of expectancy. After the first monologue, the whole company rose and surrounded Mademoiselle Georges, expressing their enthusiasm.
"How beautiful she is!" Natasha remarked to her father, who had also risen and was moving through the crowd toward the actress.
"I don't think so when I look at you," said Anatole, following Natasha. He said this at a moment when she alone could hear him.
"You are enchanting. From the moment I saw you, I've never ceased."
"Come, come, Natasha," said the Count as he turned back for his daughter. "How beautiful she is!"
Natasha, without saying anything, stepped up to her father and looked at him with surprised, inquiring eyes. After giving several recitations, Mademoiselle Georges left, and Countess Bezúkhova asked her visitors into the ballroom. The Count wished to go home, but Hélène entreated him not to spoil her improvised ball, and the Rostovs stayed on. Anatole asked Natasha for a waltz, and as they danced he pressed her waist and hand and told her she was bewitching and that he loved her. During the écossaise, which she also danced with him, Anatole said nothing when they happened to be by themselves, but merely gazed at her. Natasha lifted her frightened eyes to him, but there was such confident tenderness in his affectionate look and smile that she could not, whilst looking at him, say what she had to say. She lowered her eyes.
"Don't say such things to me. I am betrothed and love another," she said rapidly.
She glanced at him. Anatole was not upset or pained by what she had said.
"Don't speak to me of that. What can I do?" said he. "I tell you I'm madly, madly in love with you. Is it my fault that you are enchanting?"
"It's our turn to begin." Natasha, animated and excited, looked about her with wide-open, frightened eyes and seemed merrier than usual. She understood hardly anything that went on that evening. They danced the écossaise and the Grossvater. Her father asked her to come home, but she begged to remain. Wherever she went and whomever she was speaking to, she felt his eyes upon her. Later on she recalled how she had asked her father to let her go to the dressing-room to rearrange her dress, that Hélène had followed her and spoken laughingly of her brother's love, and that she again met Anatole in the little sitting-room. Hélène had disappeared, leaving them alone, and Anatole had taken her hand and said in a tender voice,
"I cannot come to visit you, but is it possible that I shall never see you? I love you madly. Can I never—"
And blocking her path, he brought his face close to hers. His large, glittering, masculine eyes were so close to hers that she saw nothing but them.
"Natalie?"
he whispered inquiringly, while she felt her hands being painfully pressed.
"Natalie?" "I don't understand. I have nothing to say,"
her eyes replied. Burning lips were pressed to hers, and at the same instant she felt herself released, and Hélène's footsteps and the rustle of her dress were heard in the room. Natasha looked round at her, and then, red and trembling, threw a frightened look of inquiry at Anatole and moved toward the door.
"One word, just one, for God's sake!" cried Anatole.
She paused. She so wanted a word from him that would explain to her what had happened, and to which she could find no answer.
"Natalie, just a word, only one,"
he kept repeating, evidently not knowing what to say, and he repeated it till Hélène came up to them. Hélène returned with Natasha to the drawing-room. The Rostovs went away without staying for supper. After reaching home, Natasha did not sleep all night. She was tormented by the insoluble question whether she loved Anatole or Prince Andrei. She loved Prince Andrei. She remembered distinctly how deeply she loved him. But she also loved Anatole. Of that there was no doubt. "Else, how could all this have happened?" thought she.
If, after that, I could return his smile when saying goodbye, if I was able to let it come to that, it means that I loved him from the first. It means that he is kind, noble, and splendid, and I could not help loving him. What am I to do if I love him and the other one too? She asked herself, unable to find an answer to these terrible questions.